This Sunday is the first Sunday in the season of Epiphany, which actually covers five Sundays. The word Epiphany comes from the Greek word epiphaneia, which means manifestation or revelation or theophany. That's kind of a big word for God's sightings. So we've lost sight of God. Jesus was born. We have the nativity stories. We have the story of him being circumcised 8 days after his birth, and Simeon and Anna being there to proclaim his glory. But then we don't hear much from him until today when we have his baptism. Well, Luke's gospel is the only one that has a story of Jesus ditching his parents and staying behind in the temple during the feast of the Passover, and his parents being in the journey, the caravan, going home from Jerusalem and realizing that Jesus is gone, and they turn back and they find him in the temple in deep conversation with the religious elders there. But otherwise, Jesus goes missing, and so it's time for some God sightings. Last week we heard about the Word, Jesus being there in the beginning in John's gospel, grace upon grace. But we begin now for 5 weeks to have experiences of God sightings. During this brief season between Christmas and Lent, we leave the mangers and the swaddling clothes behind and turn to stories of God's revelation in and through the Word, in the flesh, on the page, and in the world. We hear and see kings and stars and doves and voices and water and wine and transfiguration on the mountaintop. Most of us have never discovered a portentous star in the east. We haven't witnessed the Spirit descend like a dove or heard a divine voice booming down from the clouds. We've never seen water turned into wine, although that would be nice, wouldn't it? Or seen our pastor's clothes blaze white on a mountaintop. Although one time I was up the mountain in the Catalinas blessing a couple for their wedding, and I had on a white alb, and a big gust of wind and rain hit me and actually moved me over a few paces, and I felt like I was going to get blown off that mountaintop, and maybe to people who were there, it was a transfiguration of sort. But I've had major and minor threshold moments in which I felt in the moment, or maybe later looking back, that God made God's self manifest to me. And I at least knew the next right step to take toward my God-given potential as an individual and part of God's beloved community. This morning we have a God sighting, a theophany, God made manifest. Well, I suppose Luke's gospel needed to have a story of Jesus being blessed and God saying, "This is my child," because all the people had then was the story of divine birth, the virgin birth. And lest they think more about that and become suspicious, it was really important to have that moment documented when God comes down and says, "This is my child," so people wouldn't gossip about it. But mainly we have big blank spaces in Jesus' life. Only Luke's gospel reports his disappearing from his parents and appearing in the synagogue. In this third chapter of Luke, we have John the Baptist. So we move very quickly from Jesus' birth and circumcision to John the Baptist in the wilderness, remembering that story of Jesus' connection with John the Baptist in the womb. We remember a couple of weeks ago when I preached about John the Baptist calling the people, "You brood of vipers, who warned you about the wrath to come?" Not a very appealing way to draw people to this new community in the wilderness. But then he told them something very important. When they said, "What shall we do? How can we return? How can we turn back to God?" He said, "Go home to where you are and what you do, and change your life there. Show God, make God manifest in and through your life there." And in the middle of the wilderness, with all that mass of people who are being baptized in the water of the River Jordan, like I was telling the children, Jesus appears suddenly in the midst of nowhere. Jesus, we know that this child has been blessed, but only his mother and Joseph and Simeon and Anna know the full portent of what is to come. No wonder we don't have stories about him, because often people appear on the horizon and we don't know anything about them. And so nothing had been documented about him until that moment when his ministry began. And sure, the three gospel writers all, well, have some hyperbole in their story about how Jesus is blessed as he moves into ministry. But we've got this big blank space in which we can imagine that Jesus had a life that might have been much like ours, and that his coming to a place of getting the green light from God, the "You are my beloved child in whom I am well pleased," maybe was messy, maybe was less than glorious, maybe was much like our life when we get the green light or green lights from God. It's interesting to me that Luke's gospel begins this morning's passage with the people were full of anticipation, wondering in their hearts whether John the Baptist was the one. Because that resonates with us today, doesn't it? As we start 2016, the wonderful year of presidential elections and more debates and advertisements, we're wondering who God might send us, hoping for the best. We have a lot of anticipation about what is ahead of us. Even though we recognize the many gifts of 2015, we have very real reasons to be concerned. So we, like those people, stand full of anticipation, wondering how God is going to show up today. I want to just have a little aside before I go on to talk about the context in ancient Mediterranean culture according to John Pilch's The Cultural World of Jesus. That was a time when people really believed that the male deposited a fully formed miniature adult, like a seed, inside the woman, who was the field where the seed was planted. And that fully formed little boy grew to be an adult. Now, this was only for boys. I don't know what in the heck happened to girls. There was no understanding of human reproduction at that point in time, and there was no way to prove paternity. So it was really important, especially with the emphasis on the virgin birth, for there to be this public proclamation of paternity by God. Communal voice of God, the Father, coming down was of critical importance because it gave the child, Jesus, legitimacy and appropriate social standing in the community, and also obligated God the Father to take responsibility of the child. But that's not where we are today. We know that a little man isn't deposited inside of us. We've come a long way. So it makes sense that all three gospel writers have this story, because in the day, people needed to hear this public proclamation of God saying, "This is my son, I am responsible for him, and you need to listen up to him," right? Jesus' baptism is an important threshold experience, whether or not God's voice came booming out of the cloud, whether or not we're dunked in the water, or he was, whether or not it went exactly that way. We can all resonate with threshold experiences where we get a green light from God, right? The word threshold derives from the word to thresh. John talks about the winnowing fan and the threshing floor. Threshold derives from the word to thresh, which is to separate the grain from the husk. So the threshold, in a way, is a place where you move into more critical and challenging and worthy fullness of life. What you no longer need is stripped away to your true essence. Your God self can be made manifest at that point. And I think there are thresholds, large and small, in all of our lives where God is trying to strip away what we don't need, the things that we've put on and taken on that aren't about our God self and aren't about living into our full God-given potential. Our stories of Jesus' baptism, surrounded by a gathered community of all kinds of people from all walks of life who came to the wilderness in their personal and collective epiphanies, was a threshold experience for him and for them, and it reminds us of ours. It reminds us to look for God, to notice those threshold moments, and even when they're painful, which they often are, to know that God is with us and is somehow calling us forward into greater fullness of life for us and for all of God's people. It was common in Jesus' time to experience altered states of reality and to share them. So Jesus and the whole gathered community hearing God's words, however they experienced it, has come down to us in story. But even today, it's more common that we might think for people to have these kinds of threshold experiences, but you know, we don't talk about them. Because of our scientific and our historical knowledge, we often really don't buy the whole story of Jesus' baptism, and we don't want to hear the embarrassing kind of gushy stories of people's encounter with God. And sometimes we even forget them, or we doubt them right after it happened. Did that really happen? Surely I can't share this with anybody. And it goes away, but God keeps nudging us, because we might forget them, but God doesn't forget us. According to the Christian historian John Dominic Crossan, the baptism story became an acute embarrassment for the early church too, but for reasons very different from our modern times. What scandalized the gospel writers was not the miraculous, but the ordinary, and the early church, some 300 years after Jesus' life and death, didn't want to have anything to do with ordinary. They wanted to raise Jesus to that high priest king status. Doves and voices, all well and good, but the Messiah placing himself under the tutelage of a rabble-rouser like John the Baptist? What was he doing in that muddy water aligning himself with a great unwashed? And why did God choose that sordid moment to part the clouds and call Jesus beloved? But the humble circumstances of Jesus' baptism, his threshold moment at the beginning of his ministry, are reflective of how we change in the wilderness, in the midst of the messes, with a complete dunking into the waters of life, real, unadorned life. That is how we change. And if we have a role model that isn't common like us, then it's hard to imagine ourselves as Jesus and as God's beloved. I remember when I was ordained, and to tell you the truth, I felt called to be ordained. I had dreams about it, but I didn't really get it. Mostly it meant to me that it would open doors, that it would get me a job, that I would have a voice in places where I had been voiceless. I could be a part of a club that could have a place to speak to people and maybe change lives and change the world. But when I came to the point of being ordained, and in the United Church of Christ, it's not a bishop or a high priest that ordains us and lays on hands. Everyone lays on hands. And so when I got on my knees and the whole congregation came forward, and the association minister and the conference minister and all the big poobahs of the church, but regular folks and children, and they laid their hands on me, and they prayed for me, the earth shook. I cried, they cried. This is one of my ordination stoles to remind me of all those hands on me. And I didn't know in the moment how profoundly that would change me. Because in the times when my ministry was hard, in the times when I wondered whether I'd made the right decision, in the times when I rued the day that I decided to be a leader in the church and have a prophetic voice, I remembered that I wasn't alone, that there was a community that was behind me, bigger than my wildest imagination. And that church, that Presbyterian church, when I came out as a lesbian and had to leave the Presbyterian church, that Presbyterian church, this church, stayed with me through seminary, through my ordination, and to this day, they still support me. So yes, that was a big moment. We didn't hear God's voice. There were no doves coming down, but it changed me. But there were other moments in my life, and I bet you can resonate with this. When I first walked into a 12-step program, when my daughter Raimi had told us that she had bulimia, eating disorder, and also was addicted to alcohol. And I was scared to death about how our life was being changed. I was worried for her. I blamed myself. I was ashamed. I thought I had been a bad parent. And she was told to go to Alcoholics Anonymous and Overeaters Anonymous, and I was told to go to Al-Anon. And I walked in and I thought I was doing it for her. And after 6 months, somebody came up to me and said, "Honey, if you're here for her, you might as well give it up, because you're here for you. This is a program that will change you, that will help you repent of the things you may have done that you could have done better and be a better person." That bottom that we come to sometime, where we're willing to do whatever it takes to get out of the hole, that's a threshold moment too. It's not something we long for. It's not something we want. It's something that scares the bejesus out of us. But when it's done in community, and notice that Jesus' threshold moment was not just him and God and his private prayer closet. It was in the midst of the beloved community. They saw it. They witnessed it. They were part of it, and they stood behind it. When we face those threshold moments in the midst of community, we grow. We grow, and our community grows. And I can tell you there are stories that I hear of how this church has made a difference in people's lives. And in the earlier service, I had asked folks to gather in little groups of three or four, they like to do that there, and talk about their private threshold moments and moments in the church history that were threshold and are threshold moments. And two little girls came up and talked to me. And at first they said, "Please, we don't want to talk if we don't want to talk, if we don't have to talk." And I said, "You don't, but let's, you know, can you think of a time when you changed grades and you were different afterwards, but you were scared about it?" And as they talked to me, they said, one of them said, "I remember when I first came to the church." And the other one said, "Oh, yeah, right," because they'd come on the same day, and they fell into these stories of what this church means to them. We don't do baptism much here. I've only baptized one child since I've come to the church, almost 3 years. It's a very important ritual, not because it means you're special in God's eyes, but it is a public demonstration of saying something will change from this moment, and we will be in it together. That's part of why we pledge. That's part of why we come to church. And it's not just us, friends. It goes so far beyond this. And that belovedness, that knowing that we're blessed, that moment when I walked into a 12-step program and people said, "Keep coming back, it works at you if you work it," those hugs that I got from people helped me get up and do the next day when I was scared for Raimi and scared for myself. Blessing matters. And that's what we do here. We tell the stories. We talk about how God has made manifest in and through our lives. Even the stories that are embarrassing. Even the stories that we're ashamed of. Because we get better together when we walked together. These threshold moments are times when we change. Often we don't recognize them until they're past and we say, "I am a better person because I lost that job, because I faced an addiction, because my relationship fell apart." Right? We can look back and say, God was with us, and so was our beloved community. When we cross a new threshold, that if we cross worthily, what we do is heal patterns of repetition that have kept us stuck. And in our crossing, then we cross onto new ground where we don't repeat old patterns from the last place we were. Crossing a threshold, especially in the presence and with the blessing of community, is about emerging fullness, a greater sense of grace and elegance, a deeper sense of depth, and also a kind of homecoming for the enriched memory of our unfolding life together. So, I invite you to consider At which threshold am I now standing? At this time in my life, what am I leaving behind? Where am I about to enter? What is preventing me from crossing my threshold? What would I need to be able to do it? What blessing? Think for a moment as you look out across the sanctuary or the street or the world that someone's life has just changed irrevocably, permanently, and not necessarily for the better. And everything that has been taken for granted has been yanked out from underneath them. And they must learn to fly or fall. All three Gospels report the blessing. You are my own, my beloved. Upon you my favor rests. Imagine with me, if you will, a world in which vast numbers of people are hearing and beginning to integrate at heart and soul level that we, the same as Jesus, are God's beloved, that we too are intended to hear the blessing Jesus heard at his baptism, that God bends over each of us and whispers, with you, even in your current state of unfinished glory, with you, I am well pleased. Sense how the channels of reception immediately grow more clear and unhindered as we begin to ponder the possibilities. Listen as the interrupting vibrations of anxiety and fear and regret fade away from us and our world. Notice how quickly we want to give the gift to others. Beloved, keep saying it, and though it may sound strange at first, watch how it becomes part of you, part of us, how it becomes you, as if you never could have known yourself anything else, as if you could ever have been other than this. Beloved, beloved, beloved. Amen.